I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you. This episode is brought to you by the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, CAMH. It's never an easy call with so many problems in the world to know where to direct the money that you donate when you want to help out in this world. But what I can tell you is that when you donate to CAMH, you're saving lives. We know about the opioid crisis. We know about the mental health crisis. They are doing the work. Help change mental health care forever. Your support will help CAMH build a future where no one is left behind. Donate at camh.ca/CanadaLand to help us treat addiction and build hope. Ryan, my inbox, since we announced Thunder Bay Season 2 that we want to go investigate Niagara Falls, it's been filling up with people who want to help us, people who want to be sources, people who've been researching this themselves, journalists who haven't been able to tell stories that they think we should tell. Have you had that experience?
Yeah, I've been slammed with people that, you know, whose backyards kind of overlook where this development will be. I've been hit up by business folks that have been chased out of Niagara Falls, and I guess I'm surprised, but I'm also not. I've already been asked for my private email. We had a sense that there was a story here, and here we are. I was pleasantly surprised, actually, when I was contacted by a couple of really the cornerstones to the Haudenosaunee community down in Fort Erie, Niagara Falls area, and was told privately that when we come, we have an open invitation into some of the lodges there. And he was just like, you know, there is so much we need to say from the Indigenous perspective, and this isn't going to be necessarily be dead kids in the river, but this is going to be just like they've been completely ripped off. The land that they've lost due to development is just they have no answers. And, you know, the leadership there wants to sit and chat with us and let us know where they're at with their relationship to the territory, that, you know, their farming grounds, their hunting grounds, their ceremonial grounds. I mean, no matter where they go, they are surrounded by development. If you could imagine, you know, there's this rhetoric of Indigenous people or people of the land, and, you know, people, they are a land-based peoples that need to hunt and fish and pick medicines to stay well. And it's like, well, you can't really hunt in downtown Niagara Falls. That's not possible. So to have that invitation from one of the people there, I think, is really key. We're already making plans to have our first visit with the Canada Land team, and we'll probably announce when we do. I'd like to share some photos and just let people know what's happening.
There was some pushback. A local reporter from the St. Catharines Standard was saying, like, hey, like, other reporters have been on this stuff. You didn't discover this. This isn't your scoop. And I said, look, respectfully, we never said that this was our story. What we want to do is, like, we know that how under-resourced you are. We know that not all of this has been told. We need your help. We're always respectful to local journalists, and we put them on the show and we build on their work. By the end of the day, Ryan, he was helping us and pointing us to other people who might help us. Like, I'm getting that same feeling we got with Thunder Bay, where like there is a there there. There was a local reporter who said to me, I can't say this publicly, Jesse, but you are barking up the right tree.
We're going about this kind of backwards, right? We're announcing we're doing an investigation, which most people don't do when they do investigations. And I think that allows us to build those relationships, right? Someone memed me standing on top of Niagara Falls and then put a speech bubble next to my mouth, said, did someone say secrets? Niagara Falls has been given the heads up. We're going to be there soon, and they better start cleaning their shit up. Because, yeah, we're doing a little, we are doing it backwards, that's for sure. When we announced season two, I heard from a number of the journalists that we worked with in season one, and one journalist from APTN just said, you know, you guys really, really built on the stories that were already there. You did it in a good way, and at our best, you know, what we're doing is we're supplementing each other. We're building on the work of each other, and it's encouraging to hear that process is well underway already as it relates to this. This season of the show.
Yeah, I've got that impulse, you know, from the beginning of Canada, like as soon as there's any possible way to do something, I just want to jump in. Like, I just want to call these sources back and start working on it. But like, one thing that I learned with season one and with Canada Land over the past 6 years is you got to do it right. Like, we're still in the red for Thunder Bay season one. We now know how to do this so that everybody is fairly compensated and gets and doesn't have to work 80-hour weeks. And we have a long way to go. We need a lot more help if we're going to do this and do this right. And we're only going to do it if we can do it right.
I'm not really privy to like the inside Canada Land business affairs. And so when I saw the number we had to reach to get there, I was like, oh. Maybe my 2020 will be wide open. I'm not sure because it is a big number, and we do need a lot of support. And I will say, just to pull the curtain back a little bit, and I hope you don't mind, you almost died making the first season of Thunder Bay. It had a big toll on you personally, your time and taking away from family time, as well as many others inside of Canada Land. And so I really appreciate that this time, because we know what we're getting into now and we've done it once, that there is going to be more support and we'll spend more time, you know, being able to tell the story and do all the reporting that needs to be done. So I think the goal that we've set is reasonable, and I think we will get there. But it is a lofty goal. That is not a small chunk of change that we need to raise. So it's good to know that we're going to try to improve on last time, and there are some improvements to make. And yes, with more support, I think we can definitely support each other more and perhaps even bring a couple of more voices to the team that, you know, has an extra set of eyes, and that'll only make the show better if we can do that.
We're going to get there. It's going to happen person by person. And if you're listening to this and this sounds like something you want us to do, we need you. We still need you. We've come this far and done what we've done so far. So I know we can do it. Go to patreon.com/CanadaLand and help us investigate this story and so many others. Ryan McMahon, I thought I saw you on the CBC. On election night, there you were.
Chalk that up to weird gigs comedians never thought they'd ever do.
What else? Other stuff. I don't know. Also host of Thunder Bay. It's good to have you on Shortcuts.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ryan, the New York Times went to Nunavut 3 times, so I think they know what they're talking about, okay?
It sounds like they bought some North Face long johns and a toque and made their way up. Congratulations to them.
We will also talk today about the suddenly red-hot competitive market for podcast talent. Have I told you lately that I love you, Ryan?
Yeah, I've heard that, and I gotta go. I actually have a meeting with Radiotopia right now.
This episode is brought to you by Brittany Orav-Lakaski, Eric Catter, Surya Hukar, Laura O'Brien, Christopher, Arthur Antony, Emma Jarvis, and Jason Lalonde.
Hi, my name is Jason Lalonde. I'm a content producer from Toronto, Ontario, and I listen to Canaline because it provides a unique perspective on Canadian media and politics while remaining mostly unbiased and providing strong perspectives from both sides of the stories that they cover.
Okay, Ryan, the first thing I want to talk with you about is this New York Times feature from Catherine Porter, who runs their Canada Bureau. And the headline of this feature is one of these big New York Times features with big, vivid photographs. And the headline, "Drawn from Poverty, Art Was Supposed to Save Canada's Inuit. It Hasn't." Ryan, this article kind of slipped past me, and I wasn't really, like, I was aware that it had been published, and I looked at the photographs, and I didn't hear any controversy or even response to it until one of the people who Catherine Porter actually relied on, and a person who opened up her doors to Catherine Porter when she was reporting this piece, spoke out against the article on Twitter.
Yeah, Alethea Anaguk-Baril, who is a documentary filmmaker, she made the film Angry Inuk, and, you know, was one of the very loud voices in the SEALFI movement, standing up to people like Ellen DeGeneres and actually Green Party leader Elizabeth May, invited her into her home. And, you know, as so often happens when outsiders visit Indigenous Inuit Métis communities, they need a fixer or they need someone to, you know, officially welcome them. And my friend Alethea was that person. And from what I understand, you know, welcomed her in and sat and sort of gave her the 360 view of what to expect while in the North.
She wrote, "I'm gutted by how bad this article is and that I ever welcomed the author into my house. She arrived in the North having no idea what to even write about, and I gave her a bazillion ideas. Instead, she chose to reinforce stereotypes." Which stereotypes, Ryan? Like, what did you take from this article?
Well, I mean, oh, shit. I don't even... How long is this episode going to be? I mean, it was just... It felt like 1958. And it felt like, you know, some drunken old white men from the National Film Board were sitting around talking candidly at a small wooden table in a pub somewhere where they thought they'd never get caught. Like, this was bottom of the barrel poverty and trauma porn. And absent in the couple thousand words that are in the article is a single mention of colonialism. You know, is a single mention of the devastation that has happened due to the impact of the church and the sexual abuse imposed by those that ran churches in these northern communities. I mean, there is no nuance or complexity to this article. It's absolutely horrendous.
Let me run through it here. Let's count the ways. Art was supposed to save Canada's Inuit. Right there, you got a couple of things. Like, your premise is that art was supposed to save Canada's Inuit? Like, is really? And no mention of really what they were supposed to be saved from, except for themselves, if you were to go by the story itself. Then the possessive tense, Canada's Inuit. And then the story, you know, you say it's tragedy porn and trauma porn. This is the description of Cape Dorset. "It's made up of scattered homes, many boarded up, an aging ice rink in a busy jail packed with binge drinkers. With no movie theater or downtown, a general store serves as the social hub. There's a brand new high school, but only because the old one was burned down by fume-sniffing teenagers." I think that these types of conflicts between people depicted in stories like this and the journalists often kind of come to loggerheads. And Catherine Porter, I don't believe, has answered any of the critics, and the New York Times no longer has a public editor. People are coming to Canada Land saying, who can I direct my criticism to? Who can I send this to at the Times? Catherine Porter runs the Canada Bureau. So, like, you can't call her boss. I don't know. There is somebody, I suppose. I don't know who they are. And the kind of ways in which we misunderstand each other, I think, is that the New York Times would say, and Catherine Porter would say, we're in the business of writing true sentences. There is a drinking problem in Cape Dorset. There is a fume sniffing problem in Cape Dorset. There is poverty in Cape Dorset. Tell me what's wrong about this article. And I think that there is just like two camps not understanding each other, saying it's everything that's not in the piece. Like, there's a few things that are wrong, as I was indicating earlier, but I think it's just like you could take the best practices that people keep writing about how to report on this stuff, and the opposite of that is what I think you would find in this piece.
This is fine. Write true sentences if you want. But then the truth means that, you know, you should at least try to present some objective fact. You know, she wanted to talk about Canadian art, I suppose, or at least this is what it's premised on. She never talked about the fact that really the Inuit art scene is part of the backbone of Canadian art.
Yeah, depending on which source you take it from, the Government of Canada or the Inuit Art Foundation, Inuit art contributes between $64 million to $87 million to the GDP.
And in Winnipeg, they're building Canada's Inuit Art Center, and it's going to be a whole new, brand new wing of the Winnipeg Art Gallery, which houses actually Canada's largest collection of Inuit art. So it's a mainstay in the Canadian art scene, and therefore artists like Ulysse Sela, who she is trying to tell the story of through this piece, she fails at miserably because she doesn't talk about the way these artists actually are not able to make a living because there's such a disconnect between an art scene like the Toronto fine art scene and the communities. There's no support for these artists. Flying up materials to get them into studios, you know, is too costly often, and so these artists are left completely on their own. They're not supported by the arts industry, but they are exploited by the arts industry. There's one moment in this piece where she's basically saying Ulysse can't save herself because she's burdened by having too many kids. She's burdened by having her relatives around, completely void of the context of that's how Inuit live. They are very, very close in their family ties. There is no separation of my house and your house. Our houses are our houses. This is the way they live. And so not having the proper context around what she's calling true sentences make them untrue. And if you are not willing to go up there and really understand the lives of the people, then you shouldn't be writing sentences at all.
In fact, in the piece, what you hear is that when people do make money off their art, it actually just causes them more problems. The town's mayor is quoted saying, you know, sometimes when they get a bit of money, I think referring to local artists, they use it to have access to drugs and alcohol. I'm sure that the mayor said that. I'm sure that that's true. It's just that we have so many choices as to which sentence to quote and what goes into that quote. Catherine Porter went to Cape Dorset three times. It is not easy to get to. Catherine Porter is a reporter who I'm sure wants to do justice to her subjects and tell their stories. And I'm sure that she cares about these people. I will give her that benefit of the doubt that there was no like intentionality of harm in doing this. And I think as a reporter who's like, I want to tell you what I see and not varnish it. I'm not trying to clean it up. I think that there's just like such a disconnect with that New York Times voice of like, let me show this to the world. And I'm on very shaky ground because like the work that I did with you in Thunder Bay, we had to grapple with like, we don't want to hide the fact that there are huge social problems here. We don't want to hide the fact that we met people who were drug addicts. And like, this is part of the whole story, but if you don't situate that in the history, but that's less like, it's hard to tell in a New York Times feature, but I think that's the challenge that like, if you're going to fuck with this stuff, if you're going to go, the power that they have to define these very vulnerable and small communities is such that like, this whole discourse around how to do this differently, it feels whizzed by their heads.
Well, I mean, let's use a story from Thunder Bay very quickly, like someone like Leanne. And, you know, in chapter five, you meet this young woman who's come straight out of rehab and feels the relapse, you know, within hours. And you know what we chose to do? We chose to humanize Leanne. We could have ran the tape where she's talking about how good it is to use drugs. She talked about those things. Were we going to include those in the story? No, because what was far more interesting and far more real to that, to her truth was that she had lost her mom and she's never been able to pick herself up since. That she struggles as a mother because, you know, of the loss of her mom and other traumas she faced in her life. We tried to not hide the fact that she is probably going to relapse. We mentioned that she went missing, so we let everyone know, yeah, she's still struggling. But there's still humanity behind that person. We tried to reflect that humanity. But what's missing in this piece, though, in Porter's piece, is that I don't feel any humanity here. There's a difference between standing outside the circle and pointing at the thing and finding yourself in the circle and reflecting on what you saw. This is the same thing that happened with Annie Poutougouk when she passed away. It was like, you know, one of the most renowned Inuit artists ever. And, you know, poor Annie died on the streets an alcoholic, and she, you know, this is her fault. And perhaps they should have saved her from herself and not supported her art, because when she got her money, she'd drive to drink, end up on the streets in Ottawa. Norvel Morso, same thing. God, if we just would have kept the money out of his pocket, not give him a chunk of cash every time a painting sold. Like, this, like, why? What are the stories behind these people, and where's their humanity? This one leaves a really bad taste in my mouth. And by the way, it's not that hard to get up there to Cape Dorset. It is a couple of flights. It is expensive, but you're still flying on really nice planes. She didn't fucking jump on a dog sled and paddle a fucking canoe across the Arctic Ocean, okay? She was on a plane in a fucking North Face jacket with expensive boots on, I can almost guarantee. I'm not willing to give her a pass and say, you know, well, you know, she probably wanted to. I don't give a fuck what she paid for her flight. She went up there, she took a shit, and she should be held accountable. And she's not. She's not answered back. Twitter was loud. Sorry, I'm fired up and swearing, but Twitter was loud, and she hasn't tweeted a single thing since. In regards to this story, she hasn't responded to anybody as far as I know. Fuck that story.
I think that's totally fair. Tim Fontaine of Walking Eagle, he tweeted, "Watch for our stunning feature. 2 days among the whites of the New York Times, a true yet thrilling narrative of our time with the white writers of the New York Times." I only want to say this, okay? If the vibe, the takeaway, the feeling, both on the part of Catherine Porter and the New York Times itself is, well, no good deed goes unpunished, I guess. We'll think twice before ever paying any attention to this again, then they have multiplied the injury. There's a book about newspaper people called The Imperfectionist. It's a great title because we are imperfectionists. We get it wrong. We try again. The takeaway should not be shut up and go back to ignoring this.
Well, are we going to talk about the fact that Catherine Porter has traveled to many other remote locations around the world and has done the same thing over and over again? Like, this is part of her beat. Like, this kind of trauma porn shit is part of her beat. Senegal. She has won the Toronto Star. She went to Senegal. Right. And she's been to Haiti to do the same kind of reporting. Like, this is a weird kink for her. And I don't mind when people make mistakes. And I don't mind when people learn, especially as it relates to learning about reporting in Indigenous communities and being an invited guest there. I don't mind. People have to learn, and we can be patient with that. But when you dig into some of this shit, man, it's just like, yeah, go there, stand outside the circle and point at the thing. And I just don't. I got no time for it. I don't give a fuck if I'm on the record of being an asshole to her. I don't know her. Never met her. Don't want to meet her. To me, this was lazy, and that's really all I have to say about it. I just, her Twitter banner is her in skinny jeans doing yoga on a hilltop somewhere. You know, it's just like, fuck this. I got no time for it.
Oh, all right, Ryan. Let me ask you, rather than say what they should do. Like, you know, and I don't want to hold Catherine Porter. I mean, I think she can be held responsible for what she writes. But you're talking about an entire mode of journalism that the New York Times applies to the world. It's not just Catherine Porter who does that sort of thing. Should they do it and do it better and listen to this stuff? Or is your advice like, fuck off, they've lost the right to tell these stories?
This is up to the communities. I think Inuit people and people in these communities need to determine that for themselves. I can't say that a New York Times reporter is not allowed to go to Cape Dorset anymore. That's up to the people in Cape Dorset. People like Alethea, who invited this person in and gave her the lay of the land. And I can't say Alethea gave her permission, because I don't think Alethea feels that way, but Alethea was a welcoming body. That'll be up to the people that end up receiving these reporters and these journalists. But that's for the journalists to figure out beforehand. Imaginative actually went through the tireless work and commissioned a report called On-Screen Protocols and Pathways, a media production guide to working with First Nation, Métis, and Inuit communities, cultures, concepts, and stories. It was released May 15th, 2019, and it's an exhaustive guide on if you want to make something in an Indigenous community, here are the protocols and pathways in doing so. And it's all about relationship. And to me, it's a best practice model for anybody that wants to engage in this way. I don't know that there's anything really in the journalism space like it, other than Duncan McHugh's Reporting in Indigenous Communities book, which we should link to in the show notes for any journalists that are pissed off at me for swearing at Catherine Porter. Dig through that and find the answers yourself.
Ryan McMahon, on this show called Canada Land Shortcuts, we have features, and one of those features is called Duly Noted. Do you have something for us today?
I do have a Duly Noted. This is from this past weekend at the Imaginative Film and Media Arts Festival. They just celebrated 20 years. I was very, very lucky to have written their award show and hosted their award show. And during it, in my little earpiece, I got breaking news that the artistic director of the festival, Jason Ryle, needed to make a special announcement halfway through the show. And this hasn't hit the press. It hasn't hit the news yet. So I'm happy to duly note that Imaginative is now a qualifying festival for the Academy Awards. And what that means basically is in the short drama category at Imaginative, all of those films, should they meet the criteria of the Academy, qualify to be nominated. And so this is massive. It's the first of its kind for an Indigenous festival. The short drama category is always a strong category at Imaginative. There is a huge glut of storytellers, Indigenous storytellers around the world using short drama to not just enter into feature film, but you know, sit properly in the short drama category because that's their chosen medium. And this is fantastic news, and it really raises the bar for Indigenous creators. So congratulations to Imaginative and to all the short filmmakers out there. This qualifying festival status really ups the game for so many of us. So congrats to Imaginative.
That's fucking awesome. There are neighbors here at our building on Richmond Street. Mazel tov, and duly noted.
Excellent.
I want to duly note, Ryan, a tweet from journalist Nick Taylor Vasey, and he was pointing out that there was a journalist who filed a FOI, Freedom of Information request, trying to find out what happened from this panel of experts that was looking at how to implement the media bailout money, how to implement new federal money for journalists. There's this ministerial briefing note, and a journalist wants to know what was said. The response was entirely redacted, 27 pages of black lines. So I want to duly note that when your plan to save journalism requires complete secrecy from journalists, something might be wrong.
Duly noted. You warned them. I mean, as much as people don't like the fact that you were taking the stance you did, this might be a unique opportunity for you to say, told you so.
Ryan, I would never do that.
No, not you.
This episode is brought to you by Douglas, a mattress trusted by more than 200,000 Canadians from coast to coast to coast. Trust is important. There are a lot of mattress lies out there, a lot of mattress liars. And I didn't intend the pun, but it occurred to me that there is one as I was saying those words. Listen, I am not lying to you. I have experienced the Douglas mattress. It is an exceptional mattress at a surprisingly affordable price point. It is a mattress that sleeps cool, doesn't have that weird thing in the summer where the mattress gets like an oven. It's a very good product. It's delivered to your house in a box. You don't have to go to a big mattress store. It is a medium firm mattress, which is what Canadians prefer. And it comes with a 365-night trial and a 20-year warranty. What more can I tell you? Douglas is giving our listeners a free sleep bundle with each mattress purchase. Get the sheets, pillows, mattress, and pillow protectors free with your Douglas purchase today. Visit douglas.ca/CanadaLand to claim this offer. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's amazing the things that we tell ourselves to talk ourselves out of getting help. Anybody who's actually gotten help knows that the process of getting things off your chest, of taking your stressors, your problems, and just like not letting them be bottled up, working through just conveying them to somebody, half of the battle is just doing that. You unburden yourself. And you know what? If you have a real mental health professional, no, they don't have magic bullets or magic words that make it all go away. But often they can help you see things a little bit differently and guide you to strategies or tools or to a new perspective that actually does help. As the largest online therapy provider in the world, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Because you listen to this podcast, you get 10% off of your first month at BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. That's BetterHelp.com/CanadaLand. You know what? We're having a good time, and I hate to bring the mood down, but something's happened that we need to tell people about. We have been keeping our listeners informed, Ryan, about the best of the best of the bridge. Peter Mansbridge's election podcast, production of Manscourt Media.
Yeah.
Why are you chuckling, you monster? It's all over, man. Peter Mansbridge has announced that he will not be podcasting unless something interesting happens. There will be no more bridge. Bridge is closed. And I just want to give him the send-off that he deserves and pay tribute. Since it's the end of the bridge, this is the end of the bridge abridged. Tiffany, one last time. Take us to the bridge. When you're
down and out. I'm not actually down. When you're on the street. In the studio sitting there 6, 7, 8 hours. When evening falls. You do get a little tired, especially of talking. I will comfort you. That's enough of me babbling. I'll take your part. Oh, when darkness comes. It's not like we haven't had minority governments before. Pain is all around. Peter Mansbridge. This has been The Bridge. We will definitely get something on the air if the day's developments warrant it. So stay tuned.
You know, he crashed. Well, I'm sure it was planned, but he crashed federal election night at the CBC where I was. And when he came, I just couldn't help but troll him. And I've never met him. I called him over. He shook Mayor Nenshi's hand and he was walking away. And I said, Peter, come over here. And so he did. And I said, my mom would kill me if I didn't get a photo with you. So he said, oh, that's very nice. And I said, and frankly, I'm a podcast listener and fan. And I took the photo and I said, and the world needs to know, and I'm going to tweet this, will there be an episode of The Bridge tonight? And he said, Ryan, I'm going home as soon as I'm done this to sit down and record it in my living room. And there was just such joy in my heart. And I thought, I can't wait to tell Tiffany about this.
We're not good people. We're not nice. For every 10 emails we get from people saying that they enjoy our mockery of Peter Mansbridge, there's somebody who says, you guys are just mean. And it ends today, Ryan. We're going to be better men. We're going to be nicer to Peter.
All right. Well, I'll light a candle and put it in the window.
Ryan, you were the first to bring this to my attention. Connie Walker just left the CBC.
Yeah. Imagine being the CBC and imagine watching someone who's been there for 20 years walk away and go to America for a new job. I don't know how that would feel. I think it's a bad day for the CBC.
I think it feels good for Connie. Neither of us can speak for Connie, and I know that she's out of the country, and you know, perhaps I'll get a chance to chat with her about this on the show or something like that. But for context, a lot of people know Connie as the journalist behind the Missing and Murdered podcast series, Finding Cleo. We did pretty well with Thunder Bay, 1.5 million downloads. 15 million downloads for Finding Cleo. Huge, huge success. Wonderful piece of work. Winner of the Third Coast Award. This is major talent. And you know, I hate to say anything nasty about the Nationals so soon after promising to be nice to Peter Manzer. No, podcasts at CBC now have a bigger audience than the National has. By an order of magnitude, a bigger audience than it had under Peter Mansbridge and a bigger audience than its smaller audience now. Podcasts are going up, TV is going down. I wanted to speak about this, even though we couldn't speak directly to Connie, not about Connie, but about the trend that her departure, I think, can shine some light on and what it tells us about what's going down at the CBC. Like, it's a big deal what they paid Peter Mansbridge. It's a big deal the which hosts they put on the National. Somebody who gave the world Finding Cleo and had such a bigger audience leaves, and it's kind of like only people in the business are like, what's going on with that? And why wouldn't they fight tooth and nail to keep her around? And for that matter, Finding Cleo was like a while ago. Where was the next season of that show? What happened with that? And that was my question. I don't know. I do know the dynamics were that show was not made by CBC Podcasts, the department. It was made by CBC News. And CBC News is not really in the podcast game, and nor are they really set up to like adequately resource that and recognize a hit as a hit. You know, you'd think that in a more competent media organization, they'd be talking about what's the TV treatment of this? What's the next season of this? How do we pour resources onto this? Because it's caught fire and people want to hear this all around the world. Instead, it's a totally new dynamic for the CBC to have a competitor for talent. And for Gimlet to be saying, like, if you don't want to do this, we're happy to. We would love to make radio podcasts with Connie. So that's what I wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I do note people inside of the CBC, you know, moving around. We saw Ian Hanna-Mansing, Anna Maria Tremonti, Peter Mansbridge leaves and then starts his own podcast. How many more times are we allowed to bring up Mansbridge? but this one is different. This one is different. And I do want to, you know, obviously mention, you know, when you mention Connie's name, you do have to mention the Missing and Murdered podcast series, Who Killed Alberta Williams, and Finding Cleo. But we also have to mention that she is sort of one of the founding visionaries and founding voices inside of the CBC that now brings us CBC Indigenous. And when it started, it was CBC Aboriginal. And, you know, because she was in news, she was integral, if not the first Indigenous voice inside the CBC to have the vision of having its own unit, to really broaden and deepen the story and to bring the complexity and the nuance from Indigenous communities by Indigenous reporters. And it can't be overstated. This is a massive loss for the CBC. And I don't know Connie would be very comfortable with me saying so, but she is a shining light inside of the CBC as it relates to Indigenous storytelling. And for all the work she did on the National to bring us into communities before she was doing this podcast work, I mean, before she was doing this, she went into communities in 2014, 15, 16 to report on cases like the Amber Tuckeroo case and others. And so she brought to light so many important stories in Canada, and we will never be able to really understand the loss inside of the CBC when she, you know, she moves out to New York to work for Gimlet.
I mean, there's a couple sides to this, and we talk. My focus is always on what's going on at the CBC podcast, what's going on at CBC News. I do hear things about CBC Indigenous, and that's a troubled unit and an under-resourced one, and I think that there is, other stuff going on within CBC podcasts. Basically, they're just not set up for this. When I worked there, you sign a contract where you just give the rights to everything that you may yet create to the CBC before you even create it. And you don't really mind because, like, back then, what are you going to do with this anyhow? I'm making radio documentaries. I'm hosting public radio shows. Like, no one's making a blockbuster about that. And now they're optioning out all the CBC podcast stuff for TV production. And I know that there's all kinds of conflict within CBC Podcast, because like they've got people on staff who created those things who are being kind of cut out of the deal when it turns into a TV show. They're not getting money. Some of them aren't even getting credits. Then they've got outsiders coming in who are bringing in like news stories and turning them into podcasts who are in a better bargaining position. So sometimes some a freelancer who comes on contract is treated better than their own people. I think it's just like creating all kinds of problems. And I don't mean to single out, well, I'm happy to single out the CBC, but this is happening throughout podcasting. And something that we're dealing with here is like, now that this stuff has legs, creators' rights and making sure that people get their proper credit and compensation, you know, like things that we never, like I, when you and I set out to make Thunder Bay, like the idea that it would be option for TV is not really like, it was kind of like somewhere in the back of a fantasy. So now we're small enough, Ryan, that I could just be like, we have to figure out a way that everybody's happy, because, like, I mean, I can't imagine Thunder Bay without your involvement. And I also know that, like, if you were ever to, like, have a bad experience with us, that would kind of be it for any other project. So we can kind of navigate that because we're so micro. I think it's a real challenge for CBC.
I think this is something you're seeing, you know, because of the success of podcasting. I mean, it's a blessing and a curse. Someone like Starley Kine and Mystery Show at Gimlet, you know, that show was a massive, massive hit, but it took a lot of resource and it took a lot of time to make. And I think at that time, Gimlet knew they had a hit on its hands, and they had so many offers for TV. So every episode of that show could have been turned into a film. I mean, these stories were so powerful. And to my understanding, at least what's been talked about at festivals and online, is Starley Kine was like, well, yeah, this contract doesn't do it, so we better figure this out, because I'm the one out here traveling around and talking to these people and finding these stories. And so I think that as we kind of find our way to more solid footing inside of the podcasting industry, we might see better contracts emerge. But you have other companies like Panoply, who sold their entire catalog in perpetuity, all rights therein, to a company like WME, where they can just scrub every story, every character, every twist and turn for new content inside of the film and television world. So, I mean, we're seeing this industry kind of evolve, and Canada, it's not going to miss us. This is going to happen inside of sort of some of the cream of the crop in Canada. And it's a complicated mess. And I think the most you can hope for is that you find some success with your podcast. But what happens inside of a bureaucracy like the CBC, I think we're seeing some of that fallout play out right before our eyes. And I'm not inside the CBC. I don't know specific stories. I know some podcasters that have had some trouble, but it's definitely a challenge.
What kind of trouble?
Well, I'll burn a bridge. Maybe this won't burn a bridge, but maybe it will. And if it does, well, we're kind of already getting fucked. So, I have a podcast idea, but I also want to shoot it for TV, and we just, you know, couldn't get it in front of the right people to show that this is a package, that it would be a mistake not to shoot this for TV and only record it for podcast. And basically through a series of meetings, we're just told, like, this is too complicated. We don't have the budgets to be able to connect all of the pieces to be able to do it. And so in my company, you know, we were talking about, well, we need our lawyers to draw up contracts to ensure that we keep our digital rights and that what we're negotiating on are podcast rights. And the CBC, to their credit, CBC Podcasts, and I know they listen, so they're hearing me say this right now, and my hands are shaking, and maybe I fucked up, but they didn't say no. They just said that they didn't necessarily have the mechanism to make that happen internally. And so that's a personal example of what is definitely going to be a hit once it gets made. It's an important show that belongs with the CBC, and they're just not there yet. And I don't know, again, the internal workings of the CBC and why they can't get it together to have everyone in the same room, but we just... that's one example of an issue we faced in trying to develop something that was multi-platform.
I think that it's going to be hard for them. Like, you know, this all kind of started with that first season of Uncover, you know, the Nexium thing about the cult. And then both the people, Josh Block and his co-producer of that, are like not with the CBC anymore. Like, they brought that to the CBC as CBC employees. And now, you know, like other companies are just like poaching people and there's all kinds of options. I think it's ultimately going to be really good. Like, it's going to drive up the price of talent. It's going to, you know, creators are going to take control of their own stuff. I mean, it's not like TV or film where you absolutely need to pitch it to someone to do it. Like, the costs are relatively low. So, you know, and it's wonderful that like a company like Gimlet is like, oh yeah, there's huge audiences for the kind of stories that Connie wants to tell. So let's do that. So, you know, the other thing is like, you know, we'll see. Like, it's they call it a darling space. It's a frothy atmosphere right now around the intellectual property of podcasts. And Hollywood is really like, what is this podcast thing? It makes a lot of sense for them because it's this stuff that's like the stories have already been figured out. And we're sort of story machines here. We put out stories again and again and again. We build big audiences for them. So it's a natural to develop that. But it can take 4 or 5 years to make your first dime off of a development deal. We haven't made a penny off of TV development here at Canada Land. And sometimes the end of that 4 or 5 years is like, oh yeah, all that effort and time goes to nothing. So, you know, whether they're going to move on and start like optioning the rights to greeting cards next, or if podcasts actually become the next kind of like Marvel Comics where we just generate the intellectual property that turns into screen entertainment, I mean, nobody really knows yet.
Well, and that's one way you can do it. And if, by the way, for new podcasters that are listening to this and, you know, you think a little light bulb went off in your head and now that's what you're going to do, the space is full.
Yeah, back off.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's just...
No newcomers, fuck off.
Everybody's trying to do the IP gravy train. And as you just indicated, I mean, there is no gravy and the train is broken. Like, we are in development based on our podcast, but I've lost money to fly to meetings and, you know, try to find a way to convince people to pull the trigger on it. And, you know, that's the game in making TV. It's a hurry up and wait kind of situation. But what's interesting to me is that I'm going to guess that Connie, you know, probably didn't want to develop Missing and Murdered into TV, and I don't know even if it's the right property to do so. But I mean, we definitely, the question you asked about, well, what happened to the third season or the possibility of it continuing, is like, that's a question that someone needs to answer. And I don't know the answer to it. And again, I'm really uncomfortable talking about Connie without her here, because this might cause friction in her life, but this is, I think, an answer that we need.
Any listener is asking that question. That you're not betraying any confidence in saying, where's the next, you know, there's literally thousands of those stories to tell. It's exactly the kind of work the CBC should be doing. Audiences were absolutely engaged by it. It was important work. They should, anyhow, and everyone is asking that question. 15 million people were waiting for the next season.
Well, and I mean, you know, Mansbridge has an RSS feed that is dying for more content. Imagine the Missing and Murdered one. I mean, like, this is just a huge asset that may not see any more action on it. And I, you know, we as podcasters kind of live and die with this RSS feed, and you know, you have to be very respectful of it, and it's kind of like, it's your direct connection to those that support you. And yeah, I don't know what the heck they're going to do with it. I do want to kind of pivot away and just kind of send some more props to Connie, because, you know, she's done such important work. This past summer, she was at Columbia Journalism School at the Dart Center for Journalism and Trauma. And, you know, this is another reason why if I were the CBC, I'd be kicking myself in the ass. But, you know, she was named one of the 2019 Aukberg Fellows, which is a program that deepens journalists' reporting of violence, conflict, and tragedy. And it's a really, really groundbreaking program that I think would change journalism. And perhaps, to throw back to the first part of the show, Catherine Porter might attend this program. But it changes the way people report on these stories, and I think really assists the journalists in better understanding how to take care of themselves. And what'll be interesting is to see Connie's next work, because I know just based on her tweets and some of the conversations I've had with other journalists that were following Connie's work and have talked with her about this, that this is going to be a huge asset and for her. So I'm excited to see what comes of this next chapter at Gimlet. I hope they take good care of her and support her and resource her. And, you know, the next chapter is going to be very exciting for her. She's an absolute star.
Yeah, props to her. And props to you for that last Mansbridge reference, which was the most labored, strained way to work him in. I mean, I didn't think anyone could outdo me, but you got him in there one last time. Ryan, thank you.
I got four more of them, but I feel like we're out of time.
That's your Canada Land Shortcuts. Email me about it. I'm at jesse@canadalandshow.com. I read everything that you send. Ryan, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter @RMComedy.
Our Twitter account is @CanadaLand. This is the time that we need your help. We want to tell this next story. Please go to patreon.com/CanadaLand. And if you live in Toronto, a reminder that on Thursday, November 7th, we are doing a live show as part of the Hot Docs Podcast Festival, and we will be announcing at that show an entirely new true crime podcast. This is not the next season of Thunder Bay, Niagara Falls. This is an entirely different show that Kasia Mihailovic will be announcing. And there will be performances from across the Canada Land Network. Come check it out. This episode is produced by Tiffany Lamb. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Once again, we're at patreon.com/CanadaLand. Hey, I need you to pay close attention to this message. It is not an ad. This is about Canada Land, and this is about you. You need to know that the news crisis is about to get a lot worse. You've heard about the layoffs. We're about to have news closures, and it's very likely that we're going to be seeing the defunding of the CBC. Where are you going to get your information from? What can you do about this? You can support Canada Land. We need you to. And so for this month and this month only, you can become a Canada Land supporter and get everything our supporters get for just $2 a month. That is an almost 80% discount. The clock is ticking on this. It disappears at the end of the month, and then we will not offer it. We need your support. We need to keep news coverage alive in Canada. Go right now to canadaland.com/join. And thank you.
Witness history at Roland Garros, where old rivalries meet new talent on the clay battleground. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. Experience 3 weeks of unparalleled access as the world's top players in tennis face off to see if the veterans maintain their dominance or if a fresh face rises to challenge them. Daily live coverage of the French Open begins Monday, May 20th. Stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.